You're listening to public programs at the American Museum of Natural History. Fear can take many forms, from minor phobias to life-altering conditions such as PTSD. Now, new research is shedding light on how these so-called fear memories could be changed. In this podcast, neuroscientist Daniela Schiller discusses the neural mechanisms of emotional control and potential ways to modify or erase fear memories. Dr. Schiller's talk was recorded at the museum on June 6, 2012.
So if we go back in time more than 100 years ago, the year is 1867, a kid named Santiago is 15-year-old. He lives in Spain in a small village, and he wants to be an artist. But his father wants him to be a doctor. So after several years of arguments, Santiago caves in and decides to, okay, I'll go to med school. So like his father, he becomes a professor of anatomy. So now they have this father-son thing. They go to graveyards and dig up body parts and study them. Around the same time, an Italian scientist named Camillo Golgi developed a technique to stain tissue of the brain. You take very thin slices from the brain and you stain them, and you can see the very fine details. So you can see why this would be a really amazing opportunity for Santiago, because he can draw again. So what he did, he took these thin slices, put the color that Golgi developed under the microscope, and these are the drawings that he managed to do, the very fine details of the cell bodies and the connections. These are cells from the retina, the brain cells that you have in your eye. This is from the cerebellum of a chicken. This is the cerebellum of a pigeon. Cerebellum is the back part of your brain. These two beautiful cells are called Purkinje cells, based on the person who discovered them. So around the same time that Santiago did these hundreds of drawings, the predominant theory was that the brain, unlike the rest of the body, is actually a continuum, while the rest of the body is comprised of single cells, individual cells. But the brain is continuous, and the nerves are kind of create one network, and that's the ability of the information to flow in different regions of the brain. But what Santiago found is actually this, that there is a single unit of the brain. And now we know that this is the neuron. And this is what gave Santiago actually the Nobel Prize together with Golgi. And he, Santiago Ramón y Cajal, became the father of neuroscience. He also published a book, An Advice for a Young Investigator. And my favorite chapter is Which Kind of Wife You, the Scientists, Need to Have. So going back to our days, here's a riddle. What is the relationship between a jellyfish and a brain? Squishy and fluffy. Anything else? Sorry? The neuron?
They're both going to sting you.
They're both going to sting you. Close. Here's the answer. What scientists did is they discovered the protein that produces the ability of these creatures to glow in the dark, the bioluminescence. It's a protein that, with a chemical reaction, produces light. This protein has a genetic code, which they discovered, and with genetic techniques, you can insert this piece of DNA into the human brain and produce this protein, and now when you shed light, ultraviolet light, on the brain, it glows, just like the creatures that glow in the dark. And now we can see these beautiful images of the brain. These are cells in the cortex, the outer layers of the brain. These are cells from the hippocampus. It's a thin slice through the hippocampus, which is a region which is important for memory. This is a drawing of Jackson Pollock. Actually, it's not, but it could have been. This is another slice of the hippocampus. These are single cells, and so forth. We can see these incredibly beautiful images. So this is great. This is the state of the art. This is happening now. It's the most new and innovative technique, and this is good because now we can rediscover what we actually knew 100 years ago from the drawings of Ramon y Cajal, and you can see the amazing similarity. These are again the nerves from the retina. This is from the cortex, the outer layers of a human brain. So most of, other than this one, most of what I showed you is information that comes from animal studies. So how do we study the human brain? For this, we use a machine called MRI. The technique is called functional magnetic resonance imaging. What it does, it takes picture of the brain over time. So it actually doesn't capture the electrical activity of the brain. What it measures is blood flow. So the more a region of your brain is active, the more blood flows into it. And then, if you, for example, see different images, you would see the different areas of the brain are working. If you see stripes and slices, the middle part of your visual cortex at the back will be activated, but if you see objects and people, for example, the higher level of the visual cortex would be activated. So then you can produce these three-dimensional images, reconstruct the brain, and overlay this type of activation. And the advantage is that you can see the entire brain. You can look wherever you want and see what happened when you're doing a particular task. What's important to know is that these blobs that we find are actually, they're not the blood flow or any activation. These are actually statistical activation maps. You do a statistical test. You ask your program which region of the brain is more activated in a certain condition versus another one. For example, when you see houses versus when you see faces. And the region that is more activated gets this score in the form of a light. So these are the blobs that you see. And so these are tests that we do. I work at Mount Sinai, which is across the park, and they have a brain institute called the Friedman Brain Institute. So I can say that I work for the FBI. And they did a beauty competition of images of the brain, and this is the first place. With imaging, you can also image the fibers. These are not the cells, but these are the fibers that pass between the cells. So the reason we're here actually today is to talk about fear. Why fear? Because it's robust, it's rapid, and it's persistent. Out of all emotions, it's the easiest to study. It elicits very strong reactions, and it drives us to take action. So fear is important for survival. The region in the brain that is most important for fear learning is the amygdala. So if, which you know, there's a famous band called the amygdaloid. So the amygdala, if they want to know roughly where it is, can imagine, take an imaginary line through your eye and then an imaginary line through your ear. And where they meet roughly is where the amygdala is located, and you have two in each side. So let's see what the amygdala is doing, for example. Let's take Tom. So Tom, you know, just stands here minding his own business. Then a bear comes along. So what happens now is that Tom's amygdala lights up and makes him run away or fight. Now let's say for reasons unknown, the bear actually wears a bell. So now what happens is that first Tom hears the bell, then he sees the bear, then the amygdala lights up and makes him run away. So what's happening here is an association between the bell and the bear, and the association is created within the amygdala. And because the amygdala is so incredibly connected with wide areas of the brain and also with the hormonal system, so it can produce hormones that you're familiar with, probably like dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin, what happens next time you see the bell is that you're really afraid, as if you've seen the bear. And this is because now the bell is predictive. So this is a very effective mechanism. It tells us not only how to be afraid, it tells us what to be afraid of ahead of time. And if this rings a bell, you're probably thinking about Pavlov and Pavlovian conditioning, and the famous dog, and actually there was no bell, it's a myth. But Pavlov was studying the digestive system, and it works exactly the same. It starts to be activated, not only for food, but actually for cues that predict the food. And he didn't really like psychology, but turns out he became the father of psychology, unfortunately for him. The way to study Pavlovian conditioning in the laboratory, nowadays, is to take a person and show him a blue square, then give them electric shocks. For real. You know, you put electrode on the wrist and you get electric shocks. But you do it with proximity to the blue square. So it's a blue square shock, blue square shock. Then what happens is when you see the blue square again, now you're nervous and you're afraid. And we measure the sweat response. And it becomes active to the blue square itself. And you can do it in the MRI scanner. And what you see in the circle is the amygdala. It's a section through the brain, shows the amygdala and how it's activated when you're afraid of the blue square. So now what do? You created fear in the laboratory. Now we can play with it. This is where we can start to see how to modulate it, modify it, and what in the brain allows us, this control and flexibility of our fear response. So here's what we do. We can, for example, present the square again and again, repeatedly, without the shock. And then what happens is that instead of thinking about the shock, now you associate the blue square with nothing. And this new association competes for expression with your fear memory, and it suppresses it. A completely different strategy is emotion regulation. This is unique to humans. Instead of thinking about the shock, you can just think about something coming from nature, like a field of daisies. And this is effective in reducing your fear response. It's a top-down modulation of your fear. But we can also go to more extremes. How many of you have seen The Terminator? Good. So you remember, The Terminator came back from the future to kill Sarah Connor because she was about to give birth to her son that will kill them in the future. So we can regard Terminator 1 as acquisition of fear. A few years later, the Terminator came back again from the future. So you can see that acquisition of fear was very successful. Sarah Connor was ready when the Terminator came back again. There was another Terminator coming, and this was the good guy who came for her rescue. But those of you who have seen the movie might remember that as the movie progressed, what we realized is that this was no longer correct. Actually, the bad Terminator was now the good Terminator. So what Sarah Connor did and what we call in the laboratory is reversal learning. The way to do it in the laboratory is pretty much the same. Take a good guy and a bad guy. One of them is giving the shock, one is not. And then without any warning, we just switch it and they switch roles. The safe guy now gives the shocks. And this is how the brain looks when you do that. All these red blobs together with the amygdala, they are reacting to the face that is about to give you the shock. And they predict fear and they make you aroused. But when you switch it, then now you have to reduce your fear response in order to respond to the other guy. You see the blue blobs, and especially the one in the front. This is the prefrontal cortex. This is the crucial region that you need to control fear. It has connections with the amygdala that inhibits its activation, and it prevents the expression of fear based on your new experience and your new learning. So all of this, what I described until now, is unconscious subjects. They were perfectly aware of what was going on. They come to the laboratory, they see blue squares and shocks, and they become afraid. Can we do it without awareness? So to ask this question, now you have to take your glasses and look at the image on the screen. And don't make any effort, don't blink, just give it time and see what happens. So what you probably see is that you see this like delicate switch between a house and a face. And you can't control it, really. Some of you would see the face creeping in slowly. Some would have an immediate switch. Some would see spots of the face. So these are your individual differences. Everybody work differently. But everybody switch without your control. And the reason is that your brain perceives two images at the same time, and it cannot do that. So they compete, and we call it binocular rivalry. Everybody saw? Everybody managed to see the switch? Who didn't? Try harder. Just don't blink. Just let it happen. All right, so this is what's happening to those of you who weren't successful. Basically, what you see is a face in a house, a face in a house. They switch. So the reason they switch is that they're pretty equal images. They kind of have the same visual properties. But we can make one of them win all the time. So the way to do it is to present one image that is kind of low, like the face. It's low contrast. It's not very easy to see. But then we take another image, which is this dynamic image. So it's very colorful. It's moving. And this image, because of its visual properties, will always win in the competition. So then what happens is subjects are in the lab. They look at the computer, and they see this image. And every now and then, they get a shock, kind of out of the blue. But what really is happening is that there's this image of a spider that is actually paired with a shock. So there is a regularity here. And what we see is that subject can learn. People can learn without awareness that a stimulus predicts fear, and they can even switch it around. So you don't need consciousness to do it. It's an automatic process. All of these processes that I described so far, extinction, emotion regulation, reversal, they're effective. You know, they let us play around with fear. The problem is that fear is still there. Even though that a long time passes by, you still remember. And the reason is that it became a long-term memory. It was stored in our brain. And the way this process is happening is what explains it is the theory of consolidation. So if there's a new event, for example, fear learning, the blue square, now it is being stored in your brain through a process of consolidation. And then it goes into long-term memory, and then you retrieve the same memory again and again. What is consolidation? It's a structural change between the connections of the neurons. So you remember how Cajal showed us that these are separate neurons? They actually don't touch. There's a little gap, and the gap is called the synapse. And the way it works is that there's an electrical current inside the neuron fires, and the firing makes chemicals go into this little gap, and they swim until they hit the next neuron, and then they make the next neuron fire. Okay, so we have a neuron firing, chemical messengers touch the next neuron fire. This is how information is traveling in the brain. What's happening in consolidation? This transmission of chemicals, the synapse, becomes more efficient. It changes its structure. So, for example, you could have more of the chemicals, or you can have more of these ports on the next neuron that the chemical can affect. It's like the difference between regular mail and email. Now, the transition of information is much more effective. This is from the beauty context of the FBI. That's a real synapse. It's really beautiful. So because the memory is now stored in your long-term memory, it's basically carved in your brain. You have a trace that is there forever. So even after 20 years, you're just stuck with the memory. So here's the question. Can we prevent that? Can we change the original memory? Can we make fear go away completely? Maybe we can. So I told you that this is the predominant theory of memory consolidation, but what we know in the last decade is actually that the theory has to be updated. There's another aspect to it, and this is that it's not that you store the memory once, only the first time it was formed. You actually have to restore it again and again each time you retrieve it. That means that you had a new event. If you didn't consolidate the memory, it would go away. But if you did, now you have a long-term memory. But you're not safe. Each time you retrieve the memory, it's active in your brain, it's unsafe again, it's unstable, it has to be stored again through a pretty much similar process of changing of these synaptic connections between the neurons. And if you block that process with drugs, the memory will go away. So there are two windows of opportunities to prevent memories, initially when they're formed, and actually each time you retrieve them. So scientists take advantage of this new window of opportunity, and this is the timing where they give the drugs to block memories or to prevent them from resurfacing. But of course, this process wasn't invented for scientists to play around. So what could be the evolutionary advantage of it? And the idea is that it allows you to update memories. Each time you retrieve a memory, you actually update it with new information that is available at the time of retrieval. Then you store it again, such that the next time it will be a little bit modified. So, for example, if Tom here remembers the bear and the bell, if he thinks about it, it's active in his brain, then something nice is happening. Actually, there's this new situation where this like lovely little cow is coming with the bell. What happens is that this pleasant feeling is now going to be incorporated in the new memory, it's going to be stored again, and it's going to be permanently changed, such that the next time you see the bell, you're actually not going to be afraid anymore. So what it means for us is that we actually need to think of memory differently. What we remember is not the original event. We actually remember our last version of it. And with this idea, I'll end. Thank you.
Let's give it up for Daniela again. My name is Kira. I work at Public Programs here at the museum, and we're going to take this time now to start off with a little Q&A. So we're going to come around. I'll be on the side, and Ben is on the other. We'll start right here with you.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And I have a question regarding forgetting and can you use similar processes for remembering? Can you activate some of the processes in the brain that can be used, for example, for people with Alzheimer's?
The answer is yes. So if you understand how memory works, you can make it worse and you can make it better. With Alzheimer's, the problem is different. It's a degeneration of particular cells. So, but in terms of regular memories and how you work with them, you could definitely enhance it or reduce it just by targeting the same process.
We have someone in the front.
I heard there were drugs available for people who had post-traumatic stress that would effectively attenuate the strength of that memory. Is that correct, and how effective are they?
So there's a lot of evidence in animals. You can block this process using protein synthesis inhibitor, you know, all these like little molecules that you need to store the memory, but they are toxic in humans. There is one drug called propranolol. It's a beta blocker, and some of you may know it. Musicians or artists sometimes use it for stage fright. But what it does is indirectly affect this storage process, and that's what they've been using for trauma. And they've been using it also as a preventative measure. So if someone comes to the ER after an accident or an attack, they would give them the drug. And they found that people tend to develop less trauma. But then they also start to give it after reactivating the memory. So it's just starting. It's all new. And a very few studies in humans that have done that. And it's encouraging. But a lot more research is needed.
There are a lot of people who do sales for a living or need to, but they're afraid of picking up the phone and making a cold call. How do you explain or how do you get rid of a fear like that?
Of
making a sales call. Yeah, I know that sounds very foreign to a lot of people. Fear. So it'd be fear of rejection, but what can you replace that fear with? Or how can you get rid of the bell, change the association?
What you would have to do is you'll have to face your fear, basically. Because the moment where your memory is vulnerable and you can modify it is just when it's active. So you'll have to do it and just experience it in a better way. They actually do exposure therapy in the clinic. So the idea is to reactivate the memory and then do it in a safe environment and try to modulate the memory. But you'll have to do the sale call again and again, maybe with someone you trust, and have a good experience with it.
We have someone over here, on to the right.
Yeah, hello. So from what I understood from what you said is that it's the last experience which determines how people will react. So what I was wondering, does it matter whether it's a real experience or whether it's a set-up experience? For example, let's imagine we take a soldier who has a fear of explosions because he has gone through some explosions in Afghanistan. Then you put him into a lab and you let explode three things, but he knows he's sitting in a lab and that there's no danger. Will these, and you let him see a flower while those explosions go off, will going through those three explosions with a flower take away the fear he has from explosions from real situations in Afghanistan? Mm-hmm. Or how do you make that switch?
Yeah, that would pretty much be it, the way to approach it, because you don't have to be in the war zone again or to be exposed to the danger again. What you need to be exposed to is the cues, the trigger, the memory. And these cues, that's the problem with traumatic memories, they're available everywhere and they trigger the memory. So then you have the opportunity to expose the person to the cues and try to modify the memory that they retrieve.
And we have our first tweet question for all those who are on Twitter. We're at hashtag AmenHSciCathay. So we are taking a few tweets, and the first one is from Ava Rose. So Daniela, how does alcohol affect one's recollection of traumatic events? Hopefully not one here tonight.
I think it doesn't. It just messes up your brain kind of in general. Seriously, you cells are dying, you know, with alcohol. See, you would know.
We have someone in the middle.
When you dream and you get the same response to a fear that you do in reality, everyday life, is a different part of the brain working in that? Because as you dream, you don't always reconstruct the fear the way you have it in reality. So mm-hmm. Is there something else that's working in the brain with dreams as opposed to the real moment?
Well, dreams are the greatest mystery. There's actually no understanding what dreams are for. We have some ideas about sleep. Sleep is related to consolidation of memories and strengthening of memories. Dreams themselves, there's just maybe ideas that if we do understand the mechanism of memory, maybe we could also apply it to these traumatic dreams. But it's a completely different process which is still mysterious.
My question is, plainly put, you don't know what you don't know. So in terms of bringing up, we'll use the little Johnny and the bear and the bell situation. If he can't remember that the bear was the original memory that elicited fear, would he be able to then change the fear response, not really understanding that the bear was the really the impetus for the fear?
Yeah, so actually what you're talking about is similar to phobia. We are afraid of spiders and snakes and open spaces, and you don't really know why. So, again, the advantage is that we don't target the threat itself. We target whatever triggers our fear, whatever is associated with it. So then we can expose you to cues. Actually, that's what we try to do next with the glasses, the experiment, to expose it unconsciously. The fact that people can see spiders, unsee spiders but still react to them and be afraid of them, we want to use that maybe as an exposure therapy for spider phobics. So they will see the spiders again and again, and with this technique you can show it for several minutes. And that's science, you have to see if it's going to work or not, but hopefully we'll know in a few months.
Hi, really great presentation. I really enjoyed. You said at the way beginning that fear is the most measurable of the emotions, and I was just wondering, is it just that it's the most easy to induce, or is it actually the most visible in terms of brain activity? And if so, why might that be?
Where are you?
I'm just saying, like, why you said that at the way beginning that fear was the most easily measurable. Is it just that it's the most easily induced, or?
Yeah. Okay, I'll just talk to this direction in general.
Oh, here.
Where? Oh, thank you.
Hi.
So, hi. There are different emotions. So, for example, take mood disorders, depression. Depression is long. It's very complex. It's hard to define. People who suffer from depression actually could have completely different symptoms. Whereas fear, it's a very specific process, and especially when we define it as classical conditioning, a stimulus that is paired with an aversive outcome, and then it produces the fear response. And this particular specific mechanism is highly conserved in evolution. Every organism shows that exactly the same way. And also the neural circuitries that support it are exactly the same. And it's highly measurable. It's a very distinct response. Other emotions, like rewards, or the way people react when they get money, are also pretty effective, almost the same way. They're just not as strong. So it provides a very good model. So that's what we work with. The question if it generalizes to other emotions is still open, actually.
Our next question is in the center, towards the back.
So following up on that question, can you use the same process to change the emotions associated with love, for example? Can you make someone love someone based on a trigger?
I wouldn't be surprised if this is exactly how it works, by way of these accidental associations. So I don't know exactly about love, but I do know about positive emotions in general. Actually, a study was just published using exactly the same strategy to reactivate the cues that trigger the memory and modify them, but this was with people who were heroin addicts. So these are positive outcomes in a sense, because you really expect something good, and it could apply to reward such as money or food or other types of rewards. So as far as love goes, it will be just by way of completely speculating, but it does extend to positive emotions.
So your research is on forgetting fear and reducing fear, but I don't know if you're familiar with like Batman and the Dark Knight. with the character the Scarecrow, he's all about enhancing fear. Is that something that's real? Like, is there research being done on that as well?
No, it would never get funded. but actually, that's one of our worries, because, for example, it relates to the question of enhancing. I told you about extinction training, how you extinguish fear, you just repeatedly present the stimulus and you associate it with nothing. So this is a learning process, and you can enhance it. And people, scientists, have been actually giving drugs to enhance this memory such that it would always win. But now the concern is that you don't know exactly what you enhance. Maybe actually your fear memory is active and you end up enhancing this. So it's definitely possible that the process is bidirectional.
Yes, my question is, if I understood, I'm here, right here. If I understood you correctly, you were saying to overcome fear, the prefrontal cortex that's connected to amygdala needs to get into action. But at the moment of fear, the amygdala blocks actually the action of the prefrontal cortex to do what it needs to do efficiently. Mm-hmm. So how does that work?
It's a competition. It's exactly this. It's a competition, and with training and more experience, you make one region win over the other. That's exactly the problem with traumatic memories. So actually, the fear response is adaptive. It's healthy. But with traumatic experience, it's too much. The system gets distorted, and the ability of the prefrontal cortex to counteract it becomes impaired. And this is why you play with the balance. Actually, the idea of erasing memories, if I'll say it carefully, if you take a fear memory and you try to modify it with new information, this process actually doesn't require the prefrontal cortex. And maybe these are the good news, because people with anxiety and PTSD have these deficiencies in the prefrontal cortex, and if you can maybe change the fear memory by bypassing this process, this could be very promising.
Art making is sometimes a process of memory reactivation. So what happens to a person's symbol system and the ability to make art under the effects of anti-anxiety drugs?
To make art?
Insofar as like art is, when you're making art, you're reactivating your memories and going through this process.
Yeah, this is, it's not scientific, purely speculative, but art is a really beautiful way, actually, to change memories. You take a memory and you translate it into a completely different experience, and art has this value of that it actually becomes external, and now it belongs to the world. So you did took a memory and put it outside of yourself. It's a very profound process that is used in clinic and therapy. And also storytelling, for example, if you take your experience and you turn it into a story, it changes your experience. Now it's a story that everybody shared. So using art to overcome fear is, I think it's a really beautiful way, actually, to do it.
We have our second tweet question, Daniela. I'm right in the center. Are phobias different than fears? Would these methods work with phobias?
The answer is yes. I mean, yes to the second. So the phobias are specific types of fear. They're excessive fear to a particular stimulus. And that's all the mechanisms that we now learn about how fear operates could be applied to phobia.
We have someone in the very center.
How do various therapies, for example, talk therapy, like psychotherapy, what is the connection of conventional psychotherapy and the inner workings of the brain in either in controlling negative memories?
Mm-hmm. So there's actually a disconnect between neuroscience and therapy, and even psychiatry. So these are two separate fields, and a lot of psychiatrists and therapists, unless they're personally interested, it's not part of their training. And the same goes for neuroscientists. They just read, you know, about the symptoms of how does it look when you're depressed or anxious, and that's exactly the problem. So I think what's happening is that people in the clinic discover actually by chance what's working. For example, I think this idea of reconsolidation, that you retrieve memories and you modify them, is actually working, and we do it every day in our everyday life. And this is why therapy works for some people and some not, because it really depends on the particular variation that you used. In neuroscience, when you discover this process, it can actually explain what is it that we already use. It can give a mechanism. So now we can be smarter users or smarter therapists, because we know how the memory works. We know it's vulnerable when you retrieve it. So now we can tailor more specifically how these treatment styles go.
You had mentioned that, you know, like 20% of like combatants have post-traumatic stress. Is there a reason why those 20% are having it? Is it like a structural thing in the brain, or is it maybe the intensity of the, you know, of the fear experience?
Mm-hmm. So you're asking what makes some people resilient and some not. We don't know for sure, but there's some hints. There's some genes that are related to your ability to reduce anxiety or to control anxiety. Makes you more prone for anxiety, and you can define that before. You can find it before. Some people are different in the level of how the amygdala is activated. So, for example, the more it's hyperactive before you go to combat, it could be correlated with your chances to get a trauma.
So you've talked a lot about how to... over here.
how to forget a fear memory, for example, with soldiers and PTSD. Yes. What about actually suppressing the fear, for example, for soldiers in the war? Is there a way to suppress the fear so they can act more efficiently during the war when the fear is actually present?
This suppression is the natural mechanism that we use. We function under threat and under danger in very extreme situations, and this is through suppression. So suppression is also a healthy mechanism. It just has a bad name because of Freud or something. So we do suppress. It's a competition between suppression and changing memories. This is exactly the two mechanisms that we use. Suppression comes with a cost. There's a lot of effort in suppressing. So sometimes this is why you want to actually reveal the memory and try to modify it and stop suppressing, because it's taxing over life.
Hi. So I read about this experiment where they had these subjects meet an attractive woman either on normal ground or on a high bridge that was very shaky. And these subjects rated the woman more attractive if they met her on the bridge as opposed to on the ground. So the researchers assumed that fear and attraction or fear and love are related. So I was just wondering about that, your research, and see if they're related at all.
Yeah, so it speaks about, this actually happens in the gym also. If you run on a treadmill, like, everybody seems really attractive. The question is your baseline. If you're very aroused, you would judge everything, your environment differently. You will assess it because it's all a reference point. So it makes a lot of sense when you're aroused, it would just distort your, or maybe make it more accurate, your judgment.
This relates a little bit to suppression of the fear instinct. A lot of the political ads that we see in America, whether it's going back to the 1960s with ads about nuclear weapons or now in 2008 with the 3 a.m. phone call, relate to triggering some type of fear instinct in voters or in parents. Is there something that we can do as people who are, some of us are informed voters, to be more aware of these things when they're triggered in the political spectrum, and they may go more towards our biology than our rationality?
Yeah, so we have to listen to our emotions. So that's the advantage of research. The more we understand how the brain works, we don't only find ourselves in an emotional situation, we become aware that, okay, we are in an emotional situation, what triggered it? So you can, just as you can observe your line of thinking, you can observe your line of responding, your emotions. And that's the only way, because it's a very powerful technique to trigger memory. It makes you focus and makes you very alert and kind of narrows your field of view, so you just want to do the first thing that makes you feel safe. So you have to be aware of it, just to keep this in mind, just to be a better user of your brain.
Are there any ethical ramifications or controversial things being said about this process? Because, like you said before, neuroscience is very separate from therapy, so I imagine a lot of therapists will be upset once they stop having patients because they are not afraid anymore. So, yeah.
You still need them. You can do it. It's a gradual process. You have to do it in repeated sessions, so you still need the therapist. And actually, I do think they actually do it. Sometimes when you speak to therapists, they say, "Oh, but this is exactly what we do." But then again, they can do it more accurately and more effectively. You still need them. I don't think people would stop being afraid. You just have a better way to target this, because actually PTSD is the least treated. It's like people suffer for years and years.
I've enjoyed everything you've said. It's important, and you've said it well. I wonder about hypnosis, which preceded a lot of what is known now, but it seems to have been effective. That I wonder if you think it's effective in curative things for fears or for changing important aspects of life.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know anything about hypnosis. There's very little research done. So I guess I don't have an answer. I'm not well familiar with it.
Hi. I was wondering when sometimes you walk into a situation and you people will say, my instinct told me that something was wrong. Yeah. Is that learned somehow, or is there something other mechanism in play?
This is the mechanism. There's actually a shortcut to the amygdala. There's the low road and the high road. You get information from your visual, from the environment through your eyes, and it goes through the thalamus directly to the amygdala. So even that you didn't process it accurately, for example, you would just see a stick or something black moving, you would immediately react even without thinking, what is it? So there is this very effective, quick mechanism. And then there's this additional path that goes to your outer layer, the cortex, that gives it meaning. And it's much slower. So it is a real mechanism. And you can either learn to trust it or not, depending on which situation. But it happens, and it's very effective.
I'm curious about your thoughts with people who suffer from fear and triggered by fear from repressed memories. And how is it someone would be able to overcome their fear, as you say, because you do association, but it seems like you'd have to know what the fear is first before you can associate it with something more pleasant. Mm-hmm. But if someone has repressed memories, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, you would have to retrieve the memory. This is why, that's actually why therapists are still needed. Yeah, in this case, it wouldn't work. I mean, you would just have these emotional reactions that you can't explain why, but you do have to retrieve the original memory in order to modulate it. And this is pretty dangerous. Maybe you're familiar with it, but there was a movement in the last, around the 60s, that talked about these suppressed memories and ways to retrieve them, and many people started to report that they were sexually abused and their father is this and father is this, and that was completely inaccurate and not approved. So the way to deal with suppressed memories, if there is such a thing, and how to deal with it, it's still unknown. Okay.
We have a question in the back, and just speaking about the back, if those in the back, to just keep it down a tiny bit, just so everyone could hear the questions, that would be much appreciated. So here's the next question.
Okay, so I made the connection of both stereotype and racism connected to the fear, and I'm not sure what my question is per se, but more so whenever this certain experience and thought comes up as a memory. Are we looking for a confirmation, and by we I mean as a population, are we looking for a confirmation as far as reconfirming the stereotype and racist statements or whatever that may be, or is that an opportunity to change it and thus make a new one and undo what we were taught?
I guess, yeah, if I can reframe your question, you're talking about social information as opposed to information that is a very basic threat on our life, like a snake or a bomb. But there's also social information, and there's this idea of in-group and out-group. So, for example, for white people, there's the black, and vice versa, or all sorts of people are more similar to you and not similar to you. So actually, if you take images of people who are from your out-group, and you fear condition to them, you find it that it's pretty hard to extinguish these responses. And this is a study that was done, and both races, black and white, were similarly affected by this process. The only time that they weren't affected is if they did interracial dating. So it does capture exactly the same mechanism. You can't say from it that it's, of course, from innate or something. You can just say that the way we work in our social environment maybe capitalize or take advantage of these very basic hardwired mechanisms. And in a sense, the social environment becomes our human jungle. So we have enemies, and we have people who we trust. We need to be feeded, you know, like money to survive socially. So all of this stuff, I think it's this information that is being feeded to these basic mechanisms, and we work with them.
We have someone in the far back on the right.
Over here against the wall again. So I have a question about right brain versus left brain type individuals. So certain people are more or less artistic or more or less analytical or more or less inhibited than other people. Have you found in your research that certain people who are left-brained or right-brain dominant are more or less fearful, or have you seen any sort of correlation between left and right brain in the work that you do?
The answer is no. It wasn't studied methodically, and there are actually hardly any studies on this domain, so there's no evidence of differences between left side and right side. Sometimes you do see you see a difference in the amygdala, which amygdala is activated, whether it's the left or the right. And there's this phenomena that you can actually do instructed learning or learning through observation. So, for example, you've seen this like tall person getting the shock. So if I will now invite you to the lab and show you a blue square, you would probably have a fear response. And even without seeing, I'm going to tell you, you know, when you see a blue square, you're going to be afraid. So the amygdala is being activated. And this is sometimes when you see a difference, which one is activated, whether it's the left side or the right side. But then also it depends on when you put the electrode that gives you the shock, so we can't really interpret it confidently.
And we have time for a couple of more questions.
I'm still fixated on when you were talking about whenever we call up a memory, it gets updated and has to be restored. I'm assuming that's not only fear that has to do with memory.
Yeah.
Then how can we possibly trust any memories that we have of anything that happened further away than yesterday? If we are constantly calling them up, modifying them, storing them with new information, when I say to you, I remember something happened a year and a half ago, what are the chances that there's any accuracy in that memory?
None.
Yes.
Yeah, that's actually the news, that we don't remember our original memories. So the question is it a bad thing or a good thing? We can't, that's the question, if you can trust it or not. So, you know, we try to capture the moments with videos and photos, you know, and we look at albums. And sometimes when you look at these old memories, which are accurately captured, they seem actually alien. You really do just remember the photo. Whereas if you think now about something that happened previously, but it incorporates a lot of other stuff, you feel differently about it, you see from a different perspective, this is who you are. So philosophically, you can say that the way you are now is the accurate memory. If you want to know what the memory is, you have to talk to the person now. So I would actually set you free. Set free from trying to archive everything. Just retrieve and incorporate it with who you are now. That's the memory.
We have someone in the far back in the center, right over here.
Hi. My daughter had a bicycle accident and was offered the PTSD drug, as they're calling it these days, afterward to reduce trauma. That's not such a big deal, but what happens when it's a crime victim and their memory might be vital to catching the bad guys? Is this an ethical concern, and you know, how does that impact the kind of work you're doing?
Yeah, it's definitely an ethical concern. What's important to emphasize is that actually all this manipulation about memory is about the emotional aspect of it. When you retrieve a memory and you feel, this is the emotional memory. And all these modifications are actually on this emotional impact of it. So you don't really change the content. You can mess up the content and make it a little bit inaccurate or incorporate new stuff into it. There's been a lot of research for the last 30, 40 years by Elizabeth Loftus, who talked about these distorted memories and the problem with eyewitness testimony, because just the way you ask people can change what they remember. So ethically, our ability to change memory is more related to how you actually question about memory. But reducing the emotional impact of it, I think it doesn't give you any ethical problem, because just the way you break your leg and you have to fix it, you also have to fix your emotional memory, because this is not natural. This is highly impaired.
You spoke of there being a high road fear response and a low road fear response. I have two questions. I'm sorry, I didn't know there was just one. One is, does anything ever switch from being a high road fear response to a low road one? And do the various techniques for reducing the emotional impact of a memory, are they any different between the two roads?
The two roads happen in parallel. There's no way to control them, actually. This is just the way information travels in the brain. There's a short path and a high path. And so it's like the binocular rivalry. You can't really control it. I guess I can just say, because we started with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, the movie was done in 2004, and we think it was based on a true study, because the real study that showed this first evidence that you can modify memories by reactivating them happened in 2000 in New York. But then one day I met Charlie Kaufman. I actually just ambushed him after a talk. And I asked him what was the science behind the movie, and I expected to hear all about the science. And he said, yeah, I did meet a neuroscientist, but he wasn't very helpful. So. All right, thank you.
So, thank you so much to Daniela.
Thanks for listening to Public Programs at the American Museum of Natural History. Find out about SciCafe and other events at the museum at amnh.org.